As you know, Gareth Jones on Speed often starts with a sketch in the news style, you know, news belch or something like that. And I thought I'd write a sketch for today's show about how complicated Audi's model naming strategy nomenclature is. Never mind that other thing that they do where they sell a car based on its power output rather than its capacity. And all that's changed, and then it changed back, and then it was so complicated, I was actually unable to write a sketch about it. It's a joke! Hello, welcome to Gareth Jones on Speed. I'm Gareth, he's Zog.
Hello.
He's Alex.
Hi.
And Zog and I both hate Alex.
Well, that's a little harsh, you know, but...
We are envious of Alex. Or is it jealous? What's the word, Zog? Which is correct, envious.
Jealous and envious, so I think let's go with both.
Okay.
Much for muchness at that point, I think.
Because you went to Dakar.
I went to the Dakar Rally. Ooh. I flew to Saudi Arabia for Ooh. Two whole nights.
Wow.
And, well, two whole, one was a very late flight. But, yeah, I went to see the Dakar Rally, do Dakar Rally things, and it was great.
Was it warm? Yeah. Was it cold? What's the vibe?
It was a bit odd because while it was the desert, it was still January. So I arrived very, very late at night, and it was, you know, I think 1 or 2 degrees. When we got to the camp on the first night. And then during the day, it took a while to warm up, but then it got to sort of 18, 20. So all of a sudden, all the layers I had on had to be stuffed in a bag and sort of hopefully not left there. But yeah, the weather was good. It was bright. It was sunny. It was gorgeous. It was a bizarre rally experience. That what you have to remember about it is that as glamorous and as awesome as it is, it's still a rally. So I was there for, say, 2 days. We were there for one stage, I think tail end of stage 6, and then the rest day, so we could go and interview people and talk to them and watch stuff and pretend like we knew what we were on about. But so when you get to the stage, there's lots of lovely noises, but they are few and far between. So a motorcycle will go past and you're going, wow, what's that? And as soon as it was there, it was gone. The sort of the viewing area was very much run by the organisers. So they put a regularity basically right where we were. So the vehicles had to go next to us and slow down so we could see them, and then they'd peel away after we'd hear a beep from their transceiver. We'd hear the beep and off they go. It was really incredible. So we saw some bikes.
So they have these sort of controlled zones, do they, where they have to slow down to make it safe? Is that what's going on?
Well, the way it works is you're given the route sort of the night before or the morning of, and your navigator has to then work out which way you're going, because obviously it's not a point to point anymore. It's sort of all over the place. Then they're then sort of told you need to go to this bit, and if you miss this bit, you get a time penalty, which obviously it's a rally, so time is of the essence. So yeah, they put one right next to one of the camps, so that the camp I was at for the first night was sort of lovely tents with a bed and a pillow and stuff.
Was it like a Bedouin thing, or was it like modern
kind
nylon?
Of, yeah.
Oh really?
Well, the tent I had was a sort of circular thing with a point, a bit like a wizard's hat. Yeah, there was a bed in it, and there was electricity, or a little bit of electricity. There were carpets on the floor and all that. It wasn't palatial. It was a little tenty thing.
Snakes?
But it was very nice. Pardon?
Snakes?
None that I could see.
Phew.
It was too cold to see that anyway.
Cold snakes. That's even worse than a hot snake.
That was
I don't
a knob
like the
gag,
snake.
Gareth. It was a knob gag.
Oh, sorry, I missed that. I'd gone down my irrational fear of snakes there, you see, and that's all I could see in that part of the conversation. Sorry, I missed that. Who doesn't love a knob gag? How did the Raptor, the Ford Raptor, sound?
Epic, really, really good, because it was the one with the 5-litre V8, so it just sounded naughty.
Yeah.
It was really, really naughty. This enormous, like, brappy explosion of noise, and of course, it's so big. It was vast. I managed to catch a Raptor, a very poorly mini. I managed to see two of the sand riders, which was great.
Hooray.
They looked mega.
Yeah.
Weird, even compared to all of the T1s that we did see, it looks a bit odd because it's such a bizarre shape thing. What else did we see? A bunch of bikes. Didn't see any of the classic stuff on the stage, but did back in the bivouac. I think you just watch these things go quiet, 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 beep. It was mega.
Oh, I was there with you every moment there, visualising it.
And it was a memorable race or a historic race because this is the first time that a local has won the race. The winner,
Yazid Mohammed Al-Raji,
was a Saudi driver for the first time.
Oh, really?
Well, wrapped up in Saudi.
So much like Le Mans, the best place to watch it isn't Le Mans. It isn't the desert because there was no signal, really. There was some, but not loads. And then while we were there at kind of the halfway point. So by the time I'd gotten back to the UK, I was actually on another job in Norway, driving a snowplow when it was ending. So I managed to miss some of the results. But the thing that I always take from these is that it's not necessarily, I know it's not the winning that counts. The results don't quite mean as much. It's going to see the people and talk to them and learn about how it all works. So see the cars, which do mega stuff, and some of the official photography is just insane. Absolutely mega. I was there with my camera doing my best, but we were there for one stage for half a day, and then we sodded off into the desert to play with Ford Raptors, which was excellent fun.
For events like the Dakar and like Le Mans, which are not exactly one-off events. They may be part of a season, they may be part of a series of some kind, but they are special, unique events that have a particular character.
Mm-hmm.
With events like that, yeah, it is more of an event, an occasion, particularly for fans. It's the thing that, we care a little bit less about who actually wins it, and we care more, you know, that it happens.
That it exists.
And
that,
that it's happening. You know, so, I totally get that.
One of the most fascinating things about it is the bivouac. So at the end of the stage, all the cars that you don't have, like, a Ford land on one part of a city, and a sort of, there's this sort of massive Parc Fermé, which is a 3,000-person city that moves from place to place, where everyone has their own bit. And so as we were there on the second day, that was the rest day, towards the end of the day, the teams were deconstructing their tents and putting them onto their trucks to go to the next bivouac for the end of the next stage. And it was fascinating because it's this sort of monument to engineering and competition. Everyone's got their own stuff going on. And logistics. Everyone's got their own stuff going on, but they're more than happy to have a chat, indulge you. So, you know, there were some people working on a Citroen 2CV, this bright pink thing. They called it Dakar, which was great.
I am retrospectively making that my favourite car on the Dakar.
Yes. Tell you what, I'll send you that as a picture for the pod.
Please do.
It was this bright pink thing, and they were just working on it, and people wandering up saying, oh, hello, who are you? There was a 959 replica, we found out. It's not an actual 959, but it's done up as is.
In the Rothmans colours.
One of my colleagues managed to find them and have a chat, and then she got a ride in it, and the bloke was saying, well, you know, me and my wife do it. It's quite good fun. We've got the team. It's great. It's, you know, it's a giggle. You know, people don't do it. They do it to win, but they also do it to say that they've done it.
Exactly. It's like running at
the mom. To complete the thing.
Yeah.
Like they've done Dakar. So I was there with Ford. I was chatting with team principal there. His whole thing was like, when it comes to rally raid, obviously the cars that are still in, it's a double points thing. So the ones that are still in, or the top two, are going to be the ones they'll campaign with for the rest of the season, which means no more Carlos Sainz.
Yeah. This is the WRRC. They call it the WR2C, don't they? The World Rally Raid Championship.
Yeah, but it's like Le Mans. If you're going to go for a podium, you want to win it here. Mm-hmm. You want to win this one to say you've won the Dakar Rally. Just seeing how they all worked. So at the end of the stage day we were at, we drove into the bivouac. And when we got there, two of the three remaining cars, one of them was still out, were in bits. There was sort of nothing to them. They were a skeleton. All the bodywork was off. All the bits that were broken or needed replacing were off. And they essentially, the cars got in and they were reduced to their constituent parts very quickly. So they could replace things and they could fix things and they could test things. And Ford has these Fox shocks, so they had people from Fox over who were able to rebuild or maintain them or make sure they're okay and get all this data from them. The most fascinating thing, and I know a lot of people say it, I was chatting with another one of the Ford chaps who is sort of there making sure that Ford Performance and the off-road arm is looked after properly. That's his job. And I was asked, what is the point of this? Why are you doing this? And it's partly, yeah, a Ford Motorsport offensive. Obviously, this week they've announced, or last week they announced that Ford is returning to hypercar with the GT, which is great. If you ever wondered what that Mark II of the new Ford GT was going to be, heard a rumour that it was going to be a hypercar about 3 years ago. So finally they've pulled the trigger.
I'm not sure it's going to be that, by the way. I'm pretty sure it's going to be the LMDH class car, which will be a stock chassis probably built by Orica. I think it might look a bit like a Ford GT, but it will be the LMDH rules, not the LM,
so not a proper one.
IMSA rules, not WEC, I think.
Anyway, and I was like, so what is it? Well, partly because, you know, we want to do it, but also it's like we want to get something out of it. Anything we do, we get something out of. So with the Mustangs at Le Mans, of course, they learn stuff that goes in customer programs. There's endurance bits that go through it. And he was saying, like, this is the most challenging off-road run you'll ever do. Uh-huh. And our Raptors are Raptors. They are designed to go off-road as quickly as possible. So there is, he said, a chance that we'll learn something here that will end up on a road car in 18 months, 2 years' time. I say road car, a rock car,
I guess.
Because these things throw up challenges, and they throw up so many different things. Like, well, if this is subjected to that for so long, then that'll start getting loose. Okay, we can sort of condense this down and make it an affordable thing to put on a road car. So it was very, very cool. Some of the challenges they have. So chatting with Ford, I was asking, like, when do you stop? When's bedtime? I'm the bedtime police. I have to go in and tell people you need to go to bed because you're driving in the morning 600 kilometres or 200 kilometres, 300, however, to get the team to where they need to be. They made sure that their tents that all the crew sleep in are on the top of their vans, because if there's rain, you get flooded tents, you get miserable engineers. That's not good. They've got people preparing proper food that's nutritionally balanced, not just Mars bars and cream eggs, sadly.
What was the catering like for you, by the way?
It was pretty stellar, to be honest.
Cream eggs and
Mars bars, yeah. No, so the first night we sort of got in very late and just went straight to bed. The next morning there was a sort of lovely Saudi breakfast and lots of tea and coffee on the roll, which was just mega. Lunch, I can't remember because I was very excited to watch some motor cars go by. And then dinner we had at a hotel, which was nice hotel food. And then the next night we had dinner with the team, which was sort of, it was lasagna-y things. There were salad-y bits. It was very much like, we have made this so that it is in volume, but so that it is filling and gives you the energy you need.
Yeah.
It wasn't like there wasn't a man with a cloche going, here you are, sir.
Right, yeah.
Please enjoy.
Yeah. Oh, God, you've made it sound even more appealing now. Right, no snakes, good food, cars delivered to your door, practically, with great-sounding engines. Oh,
yes,
come on.
Oh, it was as a thing to witness, a thing to learn about firsthand, it was mega.
I've got some disappointing news about Dakar, though.
What's that?
We watched Dakar on Eurosport here in the UK.
Yes.
And as of, I believe, February the 28th, Eurosport will exist no more and will be absorbed into the Ted Turner Broadcasting, TNT Sports Channels.
Right.
Which is another £30 a month. You get Eurosport as part of the Sky package. Well, I do. There are other ways of getting it, I'm sure. But it won't exist anymore. Now, Dakar and Le Mans have both featured very heavily on Eurosport, and I am genuinely concerned about where we're going to be able to watch both of those mega one-off complex events in future, because I'm not going to pay £30 a month. That's too much, right?
I mean, it's a lot for two races a year.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden they'll wonder where their viewers have gone and go, oh, no one's watching it, then why should we bother with it?
Yeah.
And then they'll ditch it and then someone else will pick it up. So you'll be fine.
Ah, let's hope so. I wonder where, though. Let's hope, who could take it? Anyway, that's a whole other conversation. Alex, we still hate you, but slightly less for sharing your joy of the experience at Dakar with us. That was just...
Honestly,
out of there.
It was an absolutely wonderful spellbinding thing to be able to witness. And I'm so glad I've had the opportunity to go out and see it. Simply because they say there's nothing like it. There's nothing like Le Mans. There's nothing like Dakar. They're both incredible in their own ways. Yeah, very lucky, and there's still sand all over my boots and I refuse to clean them.
Who would come to the Indy 500 with me?
Ooh, that would be fun.
Oh, could be up for that.
Yeah, we'd like that, wouldn't we? I really want to go to the Indy 500. But that's a whole other conversation. Zog, what's been occupying your mind recently, Blood?
Well, on the racing front, what's been happening to Lewis Hamilton? He's been testing at Barcelona behind closed doors. This is one of the pre-season and pre-other testing that Ferrari are doing to get Lewis acclimatised to the team and how they work. And yeah, he had a crash at Barcelona. So what do we think? Is that a bad sign for this season? Are we suddenly less confident that Lewis is going to be doing terrific things with the Scuderia?
Ooh, well, you jump into a new test car and, you know, occasionally it takes you a while to get used to it. And when it's a Formula One car in front of a big audience on your first day at work, it's not exactly the fairest place to go and test, is it?
Exactly. No, well, this is it. Yeah, it's no biggie. He had a crash in testing. Drivers crash in testing all the time.
Yeah.
Particularly when, and this was, it's worth also bearing in mind that this was the 2023 Ferrari he was in, because there are limits on how much you can test and how much you can test pre-season with this year's car is very limited. You can do a bit more testing with previous year's cars, which is what they're doing at the moment to get Lewis some more miles in a red race suit. And the 2023 car is probably a little bit trickier. It was a trickier car.
That's right.
Than the 2024 or the 2025 variant. So, yeah, so if in one of his first sessions he's having a problem with the tricky 2023 car, no big deal, nothing to see. It's all part of what you'd expect in testing, I think.
There's probably no good time to have a crash, but if there is a better or less worse time to have a crash, it's during testing, right? Not over the weekend at a race, not during qualifying, not during a practice session. In a testing session, it ain't a biggie whatsoever, like you say. But because it's all we've got, we're really hanging on to it, aren't we? Well, I say we, meaning the media.
It's about the only news we've got to nibble on at the moment. I won't say feast on. Also, yeah, if you're crashing the 2023 car rather than this year's car, again, much less of a concern, you know, one way or another. It's hardly going to set you back, hardly going to cause you any problems down the line. So, yes, testing continues. I think, you know, it'll maybe only be when we get the full pre-season tests with other teams, when everybody's testing together, that we start to get an idea about how he's settling in and how things look.
And it's pretty close, isn't it, the test session to the first race? We won't really know until the end of the pre-season testing session, which is literally, I say the end, the last hour where they, you know, everyone has done their best to get their most out of it. Until then, it's kind of academic. But like I keep saying, it's all we've got to go on. I'm kind of excited by, there was a tease, wasn't there, reveal that the colour, or hint that the colour of this year's Ferrari, Project 677, the SF25, is that what it's called? It will be a more maroony side of red, slightly deeper than the scarlet, and could blend, fade into Lewis Hamilton black. I think we can call it that. He's brought it with him, the black exposed carbon fibre from Mercedes. I can't wait to see it. Look, I'm actually dressed like what I think this year's Ferrari could actually look like at the moment. I've got a black waistcoat on. I've got a scarlet jumper. I've got a Tifosi hat on. I'm completely engaged. It's
You've got
shocking.
The team look going on. You absolutely are modelling the team look.
Yeah, I could be wrong, but hey, this works for me. I love the yellow. I hope they don't take the yellow away from the Ferrari. I think it looks
gorgeous. Oh, I agree. I'm sure we'll be seeing yellow during the year. I put money on that.
I hope so. It ties it into the Le Mans team as well, which has a lot of yellow. And as you know, my favourite ever colour scheme on any car, livery on any car, the SP333 in Momo colours. Oh, gosh. Beautiful, beautiful. Yeah, sorry, I went into one about colours there, but yeah, we're still confident it's going to be okay, because even, you know, 97% Lewis Hamilton is probably good enough to win your races in a good car, yeah? Please say it is, please.
100%.
Yeah. Hey, do you know what I've been doing with my time whilst there's no motorsport to speak of on TV? I've been learning Zombie.
As in the song by the Cranberries, or How to Be an Extra in Shaun of the Dead?
more of Shaun of the Dead side than the cranberries yelping. Exactly. Exactly. Very good. Which is zombie for I want to chew your brains. Yeah.
I mean, there isn't much nuance in zombies.
Oh,
is there?
There is. You get. Which is I want to chew your brains.
Yeah.
And then you get. Which is I want to disembowel you and eat your contents of your stomach and the lower intestine.
I thought zombies only ate brains. Is that not?
In The Walking Dead. They like a bit of gut. They're like a bit of offal.
I stand corrected. Okay, it's good to know.
Yeah, news to me as well. Who knew? I'm new to this old zombie thing.
Think of it like this. You know, you have some zombies who just prefer the finer things, which is brains, eat your brains, gain your knowledge. Yep. Some of them like turkey Twizzlers.
Yeah.
Okay. Right, okay.
Sometimes only a Macca's will do.
Okay, I hear you.
Because I missed The Walking Dead in its entirety when it's happened. I've now watched 9 of the 11 seasons of The Walking Dead in about a month. I am stomping through it. I'm loving it. But what I'm really enjoying in it are the cars, because it's post-apocalyptic, so there's loads of cars tattered around the place that they are able to hotwire easily and drive away from the zombies, or use to mow down zombies. Or my favourite one is when they tied a piece of kind of piano wire or wire rope between two cars and drove forward through a herd of zombies and basically cheese sliced them through the middle. It's a terrible series. But the cars, I love the cars. You see, they drive around in stuff like a Chevy Caprice or a Crown Victoria, you know, the standard police car. A Chevy Suburban. There's a guy who runs a farm at some point. He's got a real, must be 1970 Chevy Suburban, which is just as big as the state itself. And you can almost smell. You've been to America in the summer, both of you, right? You've driven rental cars. You've been in old cars in the summer. You can almost smell the way that the heat cooks all the vinyl and dries all the leather and evaporates all the grease of the doors and the creak those doors make every time an American car door opens. It makes this creak sound. I love that. And it reminded me of something, because I was car spotting all the junk cars left lying around. You go, oh my God, there's a Pontiac Fiero. Oh my gosh. You know, I remember back in the very early days, the first 12 months when I moved to London, 1981 to 1983, I used to read Car and Driver, the American car magazine. Alex, you've written for Road and Track, haven't you?
I have indeed.
The great rivals of Car and Driver. I have to admit, I was more Car and Driver than Road and Track.
And now owned by the same company.
Is that right? I didn't know
that.
They're
now Hearst, yeah.
Wow. I loved American car magazines. You got to see cars that you didn't see in Europe. And I became really familiar with American cars. And then I went to America in 1983 as a roadie, and I was able to recognise all the cars on the road in America. Oh, you know about them as a car spotter. It's like opening up a whole new treasure trove, like the Japanese domestic market. The cars I've seen, I made a list of some stuff. A Winnebago, there's always Winnebago. All the Jeeps, of course. The Pontiac Sunbird. Oh, how 90s was that? The Dodge Omni Coupe. No, the Dodge.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, do you remember the Dodge Omni was the Chrysler Horizon, or the Talbot Horizon body in America? But they also did like a long body coupe version, horrible looking car, but did have a great engine and chassis. There was one of those, that was the Dodge Omni Coupe. The newest car I think I've spotted in it was about a 2008 Chrysler 300 LX. We loved them, didn't
right.
we? I nearly bought the station wagon version of that a few years ago. I was really impressed by that as a car. So it made me think, right? Favourite American cars. You're going to laugh at my choices. I think the Pontiac Fiero that I mentioned there, I loved it because it was such an anachronism. It was basically like a Fiat X19 for America in American scale. Mm. It had a four-cylinder engine. It was shocking, but it did get developed into a reasonable car with a V6 at some point. I love that. Just because you don't see it, you don't know what it is. I like the oddballs. I rented, I think, a 1966 Pontiac Bonneville convertible. in about 1987, driving around Los Angeles and Santa Barbara in that. I rented it from a company called Dreamboat. I was literally living the dream in that case. You know, I felt like I was a Californian. It was amazing. But if I think I had a choice, if I had any American car, and you're going to balk at this, but you'll understand why, I think I'd probably go for something like a 1978 Ford County Squire wagon. Side opening, heavy rear door with a wind-up window, woody down the side, as big as North Wales, that whole boat, well, 70s feeling.
You're a bit of a fan of the estate or the shooting break generally.
Correct.
So no, I could, that kind of makes sense. And the Fiero, no shame in liking that. You know, you just got to go with, you know, what would you want to see on your driveway?
I don't think the county wagon would fit on my driveway. I don't think it'd fit on anyone's driveway in this country. Which brings me to a point about American cars I want to make and Trump and his tariffs in a moment. But what, Zog, I bet I can guess what your number one favourite American car is. It's a muscle car.
We're going three. We're allowed three cars, yeah? Okay, what was your third, by the way? You only had two.
The Bonneville, the Pontiac Bonneville convertible, the County Squire or the Pontiac Fiero. Gosh, two Pontiacs, interesting, and one Ford. What does that say? Do you remember the way that Pontiac had this little sort of V-shape in the centre of the grill, and it was echoed on General Motors British cars on the Mark II and the Mark III Viva as well had it, and I thought that was really cool, that sort of echoes of Americana here. Anyway, sorry, go on, Doug. I bet your number one is a bullet green Mustang.
Well,
that's a yes then. Yeah.
Okay. No, my three. Yeah. That was going to be second on my list. But as you've identified, Ford Mustang. I mean, come on, it's just such a wonderful evocation of the American dream on the road, of the muscle car. And if I say Ford Mustang, I've got quite a few Mustangs to choose from. That's the other thing.
Oh yeah, it's a panoply, isn't it?
Yeah. Although I'd go for the Shelby GT350.
That
would obviously be the one to have. But yeah, no, it's a really fabulous bit of affordable, attainable performance. It's a
blue collar car.
Yeah, a long lived, epic, iconic, attainable performance car. Also a movie icon, as you point out. But yeah, that's definitely. I'd absolutely have a Mustang in a heartbeat, so no question there. Second one, also a Ford.
Oh, good lad.
GT40.
Oh, of course. Is it an American car, though?
How can I not? Okay, look, hey, it's got a Ford badge on it. It's an American car.
The later ones were more American than the Mark 1 and Mark 2.
Yeah, that's true.
Sure. But I'll just have one of those, I'll have one of the Le Mans winning GT40s, if I may. Let's just not mess about. Yeah, let's get one of the winners. So those would be my one and two, GT40 and Mustang. And third, a bit of overlap with your choices, Gareth, actually, because I'd have a 1972 Pontiac Catalina. That's my third favourite American.
Hang on,
car.
What's the Catalina? I can't.
Very specific. It's a big convertible.
Right.
Which I have an affection for, because that's the car that I drove around the States with Stevie and Emma and Cole years ago. I actually bought one for the trip from some guy in Seattle. And so it's, I guess, a fairly typical early 70s big American convertible, fairly generic. Got a lot of V8 cruising fun, you know?
I'm looking at a picture of one now. That's so similar to the Bonneville in many ways that I was talking about.
Yeah.
What a piece of Americana at its most obese, and I don't mean that as an insult.
And quite affordable also. Yeah. You know, a bit of a bargain. So, those are my three.
Oh.
And it was interesting. I only realised, having picked them, I thought, oh, that's interesting. You know, two Fords in there, that is. But that's appropriate.
Good lad. Alex, you got a favourite American car or three?
Ooh, I've got a few. I'd like to kick off with the Pontiac Solstice.
Oh, that, that was the Opel GT in Europe, I remember. Yes. A little two-seater. From what year? 90-something?
No, it was, 2006?
Wow.
Something like that.
What did we?
I want the coupe, please, because it looks a lot cooler. Yeah. They didn't make many of them because Pontiac was just going to die. It was a bit naff. But I love the look of it. I really love the look of that thing. It's very sweet, very cute. Mm. It's a sort of sports car for the sake of being a sports car.
Yeah.
That didn't really hit with the American audience because it wasn't massive and it didn't have big brash V8s or anything like that, but it was very, very cool. Yeah, there was a, it was a 2 litre four pot. I think there might have been a V6, I'm not sure. 2 litre four pot, 260 horsepower.
Pontiac, what was their V6? It would be the same engine that was in the Cavalier or the Ascona or the whatever it was called at that point.
There was no V6. It was a 2.4 inline four or a 2 litre turbo. So 2 litre turbo, please.
Oh,
thank you.
Wow, lightweight, super lightweight, wasn't it?
No wonder it didn't do very well.
Ever so pretty.
Very, very pretty thing. I really liked it.
And curiously, Alex, Zog and I, we've all chosen a Pontiac.
Mm.
Wow.
Yeah, intriguing.
Because they're cool.
Sorry, Alex, go on.
What else would I have? I would... So I'm having a bit of a toss-up in my tiny, tiny brain. I'd quite like a Cobra, thanks.
Oh, well, you would, wouldn't you?
Years ago, I met a man called Lynn Park, whose name is Mr. Cobra.
That's an incredible coincidence.
I met him at Pebble Beach, and we went to his house. And his house is sort of one of those nice detached things somewhere in deepest, darkest California. And then you can't see anything. As you walk past it, there's a garage, big American garage, so the size of a house. And then it goes double wide. And on one side is sort of an old 1930s thing, an old, it's a really ratty Cobra from the 70s. It's like when no one wanted them. Yeah, they just painted them with emulsion or whatever, and it was really nasty. And then the other garage had something like 15, 16, maybe even 20 lined up in three rows, including one of five drag Cobras, which he started up.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he is the man you go to if you want a Cobra. So he was saying, oh, yeah, various high-end collectors have gone via me to find the Cobra that they want, or maybe I've got one that they want. You know, he's got them anywhere from ratty as they come to the most incredible. There's one that's like, I think it's called Dirtbag, which is patinaed to death. It's just amazing. It was so cool.
A Cobra called Dirtbag sounds like a fabulous proposition.
Yeah. I'm just a teenage Cobra enthusiast, baby.
He was a very, very cool man.
Wow, good choice. How do we forget the Cobra or the Cobra? Cobra, if you're American, right?
Yeah, it was on my shortlist, but
sort of British. And what else do I want? I want something sort of sensible, or do I want a Chevy Camaro?
Oh, which Camaro, though? Come on.
Do I want a Ford Flex or do I want a Camaro?
Camaros, I can definitely see the appeal of the Camaro, yeah.
I went to Disneyland in a Camaro once. It was one of the most American things I've ever done in my life.
The original shape 60s one, but also the sort of retro-styled one from 2004, because it came with that Transformers thing. It had a big dirty V8 and it was basically a saloon underneath.
Yeah.
I drove one in the UK in 2000.
It was a Holden underneath, wasn't it?
That's the one. It's also a Pontiac G8 underneath. So that was their sort of saloon thing, and it's just big and lazy and wide and plasticky and tacky, and it's like a Mustang but people don't quite know what it is. Which I kind of prefer. I do love a Mustang. They're mega things, but it's like the secret club of Americana. Everyone knows a Mustang. Yeah. Very few people know a Camaro. So that, please. That's my three-car lineup.
Yeah. The reason I ask you this is that there have been some remarkable American cars over the years. And I'm talking about this because Trump, you've heard of him, said something this week. Europe, they don't buy our cars. You know, they don't do this, they don't do that. Yeah, we don't buy American cars because American cars are almost exclusively tailored for the US market and don't meet European safety, emissions needs, let alone size needs, despite America continually downsizing. But all the smaller cars in America are non-American. Well, they're probably multinationals built in America. I'm thinking of like Honda, who build in America. They build more cars in America than Japan, in fact, Honda. But American cars, okay, what are the biggest selling American cars in Britain at the moment? What comes to mind without looking it up?
As in cars built by companies with their headquarters in America or cars built in America?
Let's discuss both.
Because otherwise, if in that case, we've got basically the Ford Puma.
Yeah.
And that's kind of it, because GM doesn't own March over here anymore.
Yeah.
Which is selling immensely well because it's a Fiesta on stilts and it's an SUV that isn't really an SUV, whatever.
Built in Romania.
Something like that.
Yeah.
But GM, all of the GM stuff is now Stellantis, isn't it? Yeah. Vauxhall's now Stellantis, yeah, which correct. Isn't... And Jeep is Stellantis?
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
So is Stellantis American or is it Europe? I don't know. Mm,
they're dominated by Italy, aren't they? By Fiat, by the EU. But they do own everything in America now. Let's say everything. Dodge and Chrysler and Jeep. And
yeah, it's Fiat and Peugeot, okay. Basically.
Well, do you know what the biggest selling American car in Britain is?
Hang on, before we do that, I mean, if we're talking sort of American market car rather than American owned car, are we talking American market rather than owned?
Anything imported from America, sold in Britain.
Yeah, I mean, I would guess something like maybe the Ford Explorer, maybe, just because I've seen a couple of them around.
The European EV Ford Explorer is built in Cologne. I believe. Yeah, Cologne.
Ah, right.
Yeah, the Ford electric assembly place there, as is the Capri. But how about this? Did you realise that probably the biggest selling American car in Britain is a Tesla? Of course.
Oh.
Of course.
Wow.
Now, where are our Teslas built? Are they built in the US or are they built...
They're built in China, they're built in the US, and they are putting together a European factory at the moment, I think, but I don't think they're manufacturing there yet. It's a shocker, isn't it?
We have the Gigafactory in Berlin.
Is it working? Is it actually operating? I think they might be still assembling it.
Yeah, manufacturing plant for Gigafactory Berlin. Okay. Operated March 2022, so for 2 years.
Okay, wow. Yeah, well, maybe they're not American then. But the Ford Mustang Mach-E is built in Mexico. That's going to knacker Trump's idea. They don't buy our cars. Well, you build some of your cars in other countries too, you dimwit.
The whole tariffs thing is kind of crazy. I mean, ignoring the fact that it's essentially economic warfare.
Yeah.
My understanding of all of it is, I won't say I'm an expert on it, but I've been talking to a lot of Americans who are.
Very few people are.
Yeah. Trump ain't.
And who are a little bit worried. But if you think about the tariffs he was going to put on Canada and Mexico, like even the US-Canada border thing, the way the system works is so homogenised and so slick that various parts cross borders 3 or 4 times a go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even more, which means every single time they cross, there'll have to be a tariff on it, which means that things just like get ridiculously expensive so quickly.
It's short-termism.
Without getting, and as you say, we are not economists, and economists have their own arguments about tariffs and so on. That said, there are very few informed people, as far as I can see, who think that tariff wars are a good idea. Overwhelmingly economists agree that it's a very bad thing to start doing. Particularly in the case of the auto industry, you know, even more so than a lot of other industries. As you say, Alex, there's a lot of parts, supply chain routing that goes across borders several times. You know, put simply, tariffs are going to damage both the American and the Canadian and the Mexican car industries. And this actually may not happen in any case. For all of Trump's bluster, you know, he's already delayed, you know, I think they're delaying, they're holding off on actually imposing the tariffs on Canada and on Mexico because of the reaction from Canada and Mexico. So, you know, the tariffs may not actually happen.
From my limited understanding at it, and please do come at me if I'm wrong, my limited understanding of it is that Trump wants everything to be built for Americans in America, and he wants America to be this massive export hub. What he hasn't done is actually looked at how it works.
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah.
So when it came to the tariffs on Chinese EVs, the 100% tariffs, unless they're built in America, that was vaguely sensible because it was protectionism. Admittedly, partly to the point of protectionism so that people would by Chevrolets. The problem with Chevy's EV platform is that it's rubbish. It doesn't really work very well. Mm-hmm. The cars aren't very good. And Chinese manufacturers are coming in with cheaper alternatives. How they are funded is a completely different conversation. But what he's saying is everything should be built in America and you should all kowtow to our economic might. But he hasn't actually looked at how it works for any of it. There are manufacturers who are like non-US manufacturers who have huge factories there. Like BMW has a massive factory in North Carolina.
Yeah.
I've been there. It's great. Yeah. Spartanburg.
Yeah. And Mercedes build in Alabama, don't they? Mercedes have a facility. Mazda build in Flat Rock, Michigan. Honda, Toyota are all over America, as well as Canada. Nissan build in the United States and Mexico.
Look, there's all these spots, but I get what he wants, but I don't think he's used to people saying, but that's not how this works.
That's not how this works. No, because he has a general instinct that he, you know, thrives and does well out of chaos and conflict. So, you know, my interpretation of this is that this is as much driven by a desire to create the kind of conditions that he tends to thrive in and benefit from as anything else. You know, it's not part of a terribly well thought out strategy. Yeah, and if you want to sell more American cars worldwide, you want to make vehicles that suit those markets better.
Yeah.
One thing that is definitely not going to come out of this is Europeans buying more American cars.
Yeah, absolutely not. American cars for Europe were designed and built in Europe.
Yeah.
Full stop. General Motors, Vauxhall,
Ford.
Opel, Ford of Europe. They were all European cars. He's soft in the head. Do you reckon Trump has been watching Game of Thrones? Because it sounds like his playbook is the same as what was his name, Lord Peter Baelish, Littlefinger in Game of Thrones, who said chaos is a ladder up which we can climb. That's Trump, isn't it? Chaos is a ladder. I'm an idiot. We know that, mate.
He doesn't have the sophistication of Littlefinger.
Nowhere near.
It's going to be fascinating to see what he does and how he does it. I think, if anything, it will be incredibly damaging to the US car industry as a whole. The saddest thing about it is that if this all does kick off, the people that will suffer are the American consumers.
Yeah. Of course.
Because there is a rest of the world, which I think is occasionally forgotten about by some quarters. I mean, look at various social medias. It's people going, well, how come Europe is like this? It's like, well, Europe is actually a lot of countries, but we now know which one you're from. So I think it would be a great shame. And I think it's going to be a lot of talkings. I know there are calls go on between the CEOs of Ford and GM and, well, all the big three with him to explain what's going on. And to discuss whether or not he'll listen, I don't know. Because he might just say, well, lump it, you've got to tell your head offices that that's what's going to happen. You're going to have to change.
It's unlikely, but let's hope he's listening to this podcast and realises that he's making a silly, silly mistake.
If he is, fuck you, Donald.
Correct. A double fuck you, Donald, from me. Zon, would you like to triple fuck him?
Absolutely. Fuck you, Donald.
Thank you very much. And on that happy note, it's goodbye from Alex.
Bye.
It's goodbye from Zog.
Goodbye.
And it's fuck you, Donald Trump, from the combined masses of the entire motor industries of the USA, Europe, China, Japan, and anywhere else as well.
If you enjoyed this show, then please like, share, and subscribe. For information on how to contact the show, see pictures, read song lyrics, follow us on social media, or to sponsor this podcast, go to garethjones.tv. Gareth Jones on Speed is made in Wales by Whiz Bang.
Gareth Jones on Speed!